You said you didn't think you were worthy of therapy. Say more about that.
Say I were to write a Christmas card, Happy Christmas, love Hayley, I would maybe check it 20 or 30 times. Every single thing I do in my entire life, I do several times. It's about an overinflated sense of responsibility for keeping people safe. And if I don't get that right, it's my fault that they commit suicide.
This is In Therapy with Alex Howard, a first of its kind series that places you directly in the therapy room. My name is Alex Howard, and it is my hope that by bringing you on the journey with us, you too can learn the tools to transform your life. This series, we're following Hayley, whose traumatic upbringing has resulted in severe depression and anxiety, as well as debilitating obsessive compulsive disorder. Hayley has come to In Therapy because she's decided enough is enough and wants to live the rest of her life free from the constraints of the past.
I got to the point where I couldn't function at all. I wasn't getting out of the house at all. I can't live how I was. I'd rather die.
You're somebody that has a great deal of inner power and inner strength.
It's different than what I'm used to hearing.
Maybe it could be different. And that's a whole new potential world, isn't it?
Join us each week as we follow every step of Hayley's journey, both in and outside of the therapy room. As well as the tools I give Hayley in the sessions, I'll also be sharing weekly top tips so you can begin to unlock your true potential. This is In Therapy.
Hi there. Sorry, every time I try video, the phone's sliding, so I might disappear all of a sudden. It's sliding again. No, I'll carry on.
This is Hayley's application video for In Therapy.
And one of my main reasons for wanting to get involved in the kind of work that you do, Alex, is about normalising the conversation around mental health issues so that people don't struggle for many years thinking they're the only one, like I struggled. I've suffered since I was about 5 years old and no one spoke about it back then. And now it's much more normal to talk about it and seek help. And I just want to be part of a movement that normalises conversation around mental health. So I'm quite passionate about raising awareness of mental health issues and being open and honest about my own struggles. Since about the age of five, I've always been anxious, worrier, OCD behaviours, depression, health anxiety. That's really big for me, health anxiety. Quite a few different issues. I've overcome panic attacks and things like that. But I do struggle still with depression and anxiety and OCD and health anxiety. They're my main problems. And that's me. Thank you. Bye. Bye. There we go.
It's the day of Hayley's first session. This can be a nerve-wracking experience, even for those who have had therapy before. What will I say? Will I like the therapist? Will they understand me? These are all perfectly natural questions to have. And to check in with how she's feeling, my producer Oliver greets Hayley as she enters the building.
Hello, Hayley. Nice to meet you finally. How are you doing?
I'm getting a little bit warm.
Are you? I'm not surprised. It is very warm out there today. Well, come and take a seat. We've just got a few minutes just before Alex gets down here, but I just thought it gave us a little bit of a chance, firstly, to catch your breath, because I realise it's very warm, and also you're coming in for your first session here, but also just to sort of, see how you're feeling, how you're getting on today.
Feeling a little bit emotional, really, because everything's a bit of a jumble, and I'm not quite sure how I'm going to articulate 52 years of my life, so everything feels a bit messy. Jumble, and you're thinking, how am I going to articulate this? So I've got a bit of that and a bit of the privilege of somebody sort of trying to help you, which is very humbling, because that in itself means that somebody actually probably thinks you're worth it. So I just feel very humbled that people try and step into your life and help. A little bit of sort of headache with the hot weather and getting here, because I come from quite far away, but
privileged, really, that somebody's just trying to help you.
Sure. Well, obviously, don't worry too much about the whole, you know, processing 52 years of your life in one go. Alex will obviously ask you, you know, the questions and be able to sort of help you process through that, and it won't all happen at once, but, you know, just to put your mind at ease a little bit there. I'm conscious that obviously I'm bombarding you as you've come up straight up the stairs. Would you like a cup of tea or a drink of water or anything?
Just love absolutely anything. Yeah, just whatever is fine. Okay. Thank you.
To keep this process as authentic as possible, this is the first time I'm meeting Hayley in person, but I do have some notes from my team on what she's here to work on. As a therapist, it is my job to understand the client's experience. It is only with that understanding that I'm able to teach them the most effective tools for change. Therefore, the first session is often like a game of 20 questions. The conversation can appear to jump around a lot. Here's the session.
I think the most important starting point for me is to get a sense of really what you hope to get from being part of this process, and particularly what you hope to get for you. I know that you're very passionate about the importance of conversation and dialogue around mental health, and I really appreciate that being part of the kind of thrust of your wish to be part of this. But particularly for you, like if you imagine at the end of the sessions we've got together, for you to look back and go, oh yeah, I really feel like that's what I was hoping was going to happen. What would that be for you?
Just some tools, really, to help me to cope better with day-to-day life. I'd like to go back to work. I've not worked for 20 years. I'd like to get some confidence and skills to go back to work, really. Mm. See, I've gone blank. I'm ever so sorry.
No, okay. Don't worry. Do you know what? It's an unusual thing, yeah. Just like doing a therapeutic environment, yeah. But then you start sticking cameras and a strange person walking around in the background. I'm not surprised. What I think you'll find is after a while it'll be easier to get familiar with that. I remember from the notes that I saw that you had a heart condition diagnosed at 39, and that's when you stopped working, right?
No, I stopped working before then because I'd had a complete mental breakdown.
Okay.
So I guess I've struggled with severe OCD and anxiety since I was about five. And so I managed to work for quite a while, and then everything broke into a million pieces and I stopped working. So it was before the heart attack that I'd stopped working because of severe anxiety and OCD behaviour. The heart attack was actually a really good turning point for me. Mm. So that was, in a weird way, it was really positive.
You're not prescribing it for other people, I assume.
No, I don't recommend it. But that was the turning point. That was this is going to kill you if you don't get a grip. Because I think I pushed my body into a rare heart attack, like really rare, really, really rare.
Rare in what way?
Yeah. So it's called a spontaneous coronary artery dissection, and I was one of the first people to be diagnosed with it.
That's probably why I haven't heard of it.
Yeah. So there was no risk factors for it whatsoever. There's no coronary heart disease in my family or anything, and it just popped. Coronary arteries in my heart just tore. And it was a proper heart attack, nearly died, very close to dying. And it took them at least 8 years to diagnose it. And then more people started coming forward with it. And it's very, very linked to severe anxiety and stuff.
Right.
So I'm sure you probably believe that we are holistic, aren't we? Yeah. This mind affects the body. And I was just at breaking point and everything just popped. And it was always good.
Literally and metaphorically.
It just went, yeah. So, yeah.
And what kind of work were you doing before that?
So I was working with children with autism, which I really loved.
And working with them in what capacity? Is it in teaching or providing support services? Or?
Yeah, in a residential children's home. Yeah. So teaching, taking them out and stuff. So I loved it. Absolutely loved it. But, you know, I've always struggled with the way my OCD affects me is I can't do anything once. I check everything. And I get really intrusive thoughts and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so, say I were to write a Christmas card to someone, Happy Christmas, love Hayley. I would maybe check it 20 or 30 times before I posted it, in case I'd written something offensive or upsetting in it. And every single thing I do in my entire life, I do several times.
And what's the fear of what would happen if you didn't? So, yeah, what's the kind of drive behind it?
It's in case I offend or upset anyone and therefore become, it's my fault that they commit suicide. And I know where this is going because it's not my mum's fault, but she kept, and she still does, keep saying she's going to commit suicide. So it's not her fault.
It's linked, but it's linked to a very specific kind of trauma, in a sense.
Yeah, it's not her fault, but she sort of said all along, you know, I'm going to commit suicide, I'm going to kill myself. I know where it comes from, and I can intellectually map it. I've got it nailed. I know where it comes from, and I know how I tick, and I kind of know the cognitive behavior therapy techniques and all this, but I've got the pieces of the jigsaw and I can't put them together emotionally. But it's coming from childhood, I know.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It does. So give me some more examples of how the OCD manifests day-to-day. So writing the cards, one good example. What might be some other ways that you find the repetitive behaviour needing to happen?
Yeah, so when I was living at home, it used to be safety behaviours. I used to feel responsible for keeping my parents safe in the house. So gas safety checks, door checks, there's no fires, health checks, so like what really bad health anxiety. So it would be checking, oh, you've got a mole, let's make sure it's not cancerous mole, or what's that lump, what's that, you know, so health safety checks. It's about an overinflated sense of responsibility for keeping people safe. And if I don't get that right, there's a really bad consequence. So I know it's catastrophic thinking and stuff. But it's literally like I'm 52 years old and I put my hand on my heart, I've never cooked a meal in my life. At 52, I'm not doing grown-up stuff. I'm like a little kid.
And when you say never cooked a meal, so someone's cooking?
Because if I don't cook it right, someone will get food poisoning, get ill and die. Okay. Or I won't turn the gas off and the house will blow up. Or I'll give somebody food poisoning. And if I'm ill, it doesn't matter if I'm ill, but then I can't get to help my mum and dad if they need me.
Yeah.
So it's better to not do it.
And so your husband does the cooking? Or?
Yeah, cooking. Just bills, online banking, grown-up stuff. I don't do any grown-up stuff and I don't do anything once. It's multiple times. I understand it and I know where it comes from.
Yeah, so you understand it rationally, logically. So just to make sure I reflect it back, to make sure I understand what you're saying. So you'll be doing a thing, and if I don't do this right, the outcome will be catastrophic. Yeah. So it's a kind of leap from this to this. And the way that you prevent this from happening is either by avoidant behavior, so you don't do it in the first place, or if you do it, then you have to check it multiple times to be absolutely sure. When you do it multiple times, how do you know you've done it enough times? Like, what's the feeling or the thought that you get that says, okay, now I can let this go?
Yeah, it gets harder to get that feeling. At my worst, I was 20 hours a day checking stuff. I didn't leave the house for 2 years. I'm sleeping on the front seat of my car. That's when I had the heart attack, which probably saved my life. But yeah, I know what you're going to say. You're going to say that you're not going to find a feeling of peace in a ramped up emotional state. Was that what you're going to say?
It sounds like something I would have said. I just wasn't there yet.
See, I'm better than you. I don't need you. We're done here. Yeah, but I understand that you're not going to get that feeling of okayness. Are you in a ramped up emotional state? Yeah.
It sounds like you've tried some different things. So it sounds like you've done some CBT, you've done some counselling, you've done some counselling training. So what have you tried? What has helped? What hasn't helped? Particularly, it sounds like after the heart attack, something did shift. And I'm wondering what that was.
To be honest, I haven't really had much counselling, which is maybe quite surprising. I don't know. But I haven't actually really had any. I started off, I mean, I don't know if you want me to go into that, but I started off with a little bit of CBT. Mm.
CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, aims to manage your problems by changing the way you think and behave.
It was like, felt like a sticking plaster rather than getting to the root of it. It's like, oh, just don't check 10 times, check 5. And it's like, well, that's not really that helpful. Stuff that has helped. I really like exercise. Love it, absolutely love it. But the problem is I'm losing that as a coping mechanism because, like, my knee keeps... I've torn my meniscus, and every time I try and play badminton, my knee has gone 4 times this year.
Okay.
So it's giving me real hassle. It's like dislocating. So I'm limping everywhere now. So I'm scared to lose that as a coping mechanism, but it helps me.
And badminton is the primary exercise, or you do other forms of that?
I like jogging. So hopefully when the knee heals a bit, I will continue to jog because it's not twisting and turning. Yeah. So it's holding the knee stable. So really love exercise. I love it. I absolutely love it. So that helps. For the first time ever, I've managed to get some really good friends. Because not working, you're quite isolated.
Yes.
So I've got some really good friends. I've done a little tiny bit of counselling training. I met some amazing friends. And it's the first time ever, because I'm quite isolated. It's like, oh my goodness, these people are so nice. So I can see that that's really healthy. Amazing people. So I've got some friends because we're quite cut off from my family and my husband. So for friends. Mm. Good friends. So that's helped. Learning about stuff helps. I was reading books on neuroplasticity in my brain and amygdala cortex and all this.
Yeah.
So intellectually learning about it, okay, it's not doing anything. It is helping a bit.
Yeah, because it takes away some of the mystery and some of the power from it, right? Like you can recognize, okay, even though I don't want to be doing it, I can see why it's happening and that makes sense. And so in a sense that there's a calmer place you're meeting it, as opposed to it's happening and a lot of agitation about the fact that it's happening. Why? I'm curious as to why you haven't done therapy and counselling or therapeutic work over the years. What stopped you from doing that?
I've spent most of my life, until more recently, not realising that there was other people struggling as much as I. So a lot of it in the first years was like, I didn't realise anybody else had got it or didn't think I was worthy of therapy.
I didn't think I was worthy of therapy. And sadly, this is an all too common belief. People think my problems aren't as bad as other people's problems, or asking for help is a sign of weakness, or I just need to think more positively about things. But the truth is, everyone is worthy of therapy. We all struggle. And asking for help isn't a sign of weakness. It's the opposite. It's a sign of strength and self-love. And the strength to stand up and say, I'm worthy of help and I'm going to ask for it. I then ask Hayley a question that clearly shakes her.
You said you didn't think you were worthy of therapy. Say more about that. What comes up? And it still feels true for you. Well, what helps you be here?
Like when people were fighting for my life when I had a heart attack. I was saying to him, just don't bother, you know. And the fact that people were fighting for me, and they were really fighting. There was a massive team at 2 hospitals.
Worked very hard to bring you back.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my goodness, you might be doing it because you're getting paid for it, but to me, you look like you care. So it's like people caring into it.
Well, obviously, if you've got the intelligence to do that, you could do things you get paid a lot more for if your motivation is money, right? But it's interesting to back up. It sounds like that there's some quite strong beliefs here that you've developed, one of which it sounds like is I'm not worthy of help. But it sounds like there's another one that's implicit in some of what you've been saying, which is that it won't work or I can't change anyway. Like it sounds like with some of the therapeutic things that it was almost like, well, this is just how it's always going to be. It's not going to be something that's going to be different. And I'm wondering if over the years you've sort of resigned yourself to things being the way that they are. And that's been, in a sense, an obstacle to reaching out for help, because if you've not believed that things can change, there's not much point in reaching out. Something obviously is a bit different because you're here, and I don't think you'd be here investing your time and traveling to London and the time of this process if a part of you didn't really believe things can be different. So I'm curious about that as well.
I guess I'm here because I've met some people that are really nice to me, that have been so nice to me that they maybe think that life's worth living, which I haven't felt before. I was just here for a purpose, to look after my parents, and then I'd almost resided in my mind, I can duck out then, you know, I'm gone. So I guess they've made me believe that life's okay for the first time ever, and I really mean for the first time ever. So it's a bit of empowerment from the people that I've met, and there's a bit of terror seeing my parents' health deteriorating, thinking I have no resources to cope with their death. So it's a bit of a seesaw. It's a bit, friends have encouraged me to fight, but I'm afraid that life's going to swallow me up because I'm running out of resources because my knee's gone and my parents are old and they're slipping away in front of me. Does that make any sense?
It does. It does make sense. What is your, given what you described about the history with your mum around the kind of using of threatening suicide as a way of manipulating and driving behavior, what is that relationship like for you at this point? Because that must be quite complex.
Absolutely. She I absolutely adore her, and I'm sure she loves me in her own way. And it's not her fault for anything she's ever done. Because I think people or how they are because of what they've been through. So I think it trickles down the line. So we love each other in our way, but it's an interesting question. It's big.
How is the dynamic day to day in terms of the relationship? I'm mindful. I saw a note in the notes that I was given that you were not keen to get into a relationship with your parents on camera. So if we don't want some of this to be used, that's okay. I just need to understand the context in terms of what's happening.
What follows is a particularly candid account of Hayley's relationship with her mother, which is given under the assurance that it will be edited out of the episode. Hayley later gave us permission to use the content about her mother in the series. However, out of respect, we haven't included this segment in the episode. It's important to make clear that although Hayley's mother clearly has a big impact on Hayley's mental state, she's not the one in therapy. Therefore, it's not my place to try to change her mother's character. What we can change is how Hayley relates to her mother's behavior, and give her the tools to shift the dynamic. For clarity, from this moment on in the session, we agree to refer to her mother as people in your life.
So I want to go back to something that you said a little bit earlier in terms of certain individuals or people in your life acting in abusive ways, but also particularly what I call the weaponizing of suicide. And what I mean by that is when people have the threat that if you don't do what I want you to do, or you don't respond the way I want you to respond, then I'm going to kill myself. That is a very powerful weapon if someone is allowed to use it. We can get more into this as is appropriate, but I just want to lay out at this point, because I think it is really important, that it's a very difficult place to be placed, but ultimately it is not a place we can allow ourselves to continue to be placed, because ultimately your emotional life and your inner life has to be under your direction, not somebody else's direction in some way. And I just wonder how it is for you just even talking about it and hearing me say that.
Yeah, The trouble with me is I take ages to process something. So,
well, we're talking about some pretty heavy big things, so you're allowed to have some time to process.
Okay, it's all processed. Yeah, I'm done now. I appreciate you saying that, and I will take it and I will think about it and think about it and think about it. And stuff doesn't occur to you because my life's been like this. And I've never had anybody coming in saying, hang on a minute, you know, A, you're worth it, or B, you can change, or C, you can think about things differently, or E, this isn't appropriate. Nobody's fought my corner before and said, hang on, let's just, you know, look at this. So I know I need to look at it emotionally and intellectually, and I need to take time to do that.
Yeah, that's good. And it's a big thing, and it's all something that's been this way for decades, in a sense. You've got.
I'm not that old. Go steady.
I'm not that old either, but I've been here for 4 decades, so we're not here. But also, to echo what you just said, we normalize to things being a certain way, right? And sometimes what happens is we have a conversation like this, and we go away and we think about it, and suddenly something that seemed so normal for a long time suddenly no longer fits. It's almost like having a pair of shoes that we grow out of that for a long time were comfortable, and then we put them on and they just don't fit right anymore. They've worn away too much, and well, the bit that used to be so soft and cozy is now worn, and it's just, they, you know, something new needs to happen. And I think, and I think also when there is a history of OCD tendencies and anxiety, I think it's also important to say to you that this process and your inner process can happen at the speed that's right for you. So this is not, in my mind, a real sign of great therapeutic work for you would be for you to say to me at some point, too fast, need some space. In fact, you almost did it a moment ago, so I just need some time to process. That is you acknowledging your needs and expressing your needs. And this is, you know, this is a collaborative process where my intention is to use my skills and my experience to help you the best that I can. But I'm not here to do anything to you. I'm here to help you have different strategies and different ways to do things yourself. You said a little bit earlier that you haven't managed to put the puzzle together before, but you understand these different pieces. Going back to my early question for you, my first question of what do you hope to get from this? Well, hopefully one of the things is to be able to put the puzzle together a bit more, but not just put it together as an intellectual thing, but actually to have some different tools and strategies that things can go at your pace, that you don't feel that, you know, that you're being pushed, but also you feel empowered. And when I hear you say, you ran 6 marathons after a heart attack.
Yeah, it was a bit, I thought I'd test my anxiety and my fears to the limit. I thought,
I mean, that's one way to do it.
Yeah, we are, you know, flooding. I thought I'd flood it. But I was very agoraphobic, didn't get out of the house for 2 years. And I fought back from panic attacks because they really ruined my life, and I'm absolutely fine now, 100% fine. But I thought this heart attack has the potential to push me back into that state. So I thought I've got 2 choices. I can either test it and push it, or I can become a recluse and too afraid to do anything again. So I thought I'm going to go for it. So I tested it and did London 3 times, Edinburgh 3 times. And I thought, right, you know, because I can't live how I was. I'd rather die than live how I was. It was that bad. So, yeah, it was really good. So I don't have panic attacks anymore. And I'm not.
And what helped with the panic attacks? Just going out and challenging yourself?
Yeah, just that. Just I got to the point where I couldn't function at all. I wasn't getting out of the house at all. And I got so sick of it. I just thought, I ran out in the street and I shouted at the top of my voice, if you're going to kill me, just bloody kill me. And I never had a panic attack since. So it's just like, it's that breaking point, isn't it, where you choose life or choose, you know. So
I mean, it strikes me that you're somebody that has a great deal of inner power and inner strength. It might not feel like that to you, but the fact that you can go from that point of feeling completely sort of frozen and shut down in yourself to then going out and literally run it, right? Not metaphorically, like literally running marathons, that also some of the heaviness and the difficulties and the experiences that we've touched on that you've endured, you must have a lot of strength to be able to have tolerated and put up with that. What do you think?
It hadn't occurred to me. Thank you.
Wow. I'm just pointing out what I see.
Thank you.
What does it feel like to recognise that may be true for you?
It's different than what I'm used to hearing. sort of the usual stuff I get is stupid little child and useless, and if anybody knew what you really like, and just a bit of negativity. And when
you hear that, what happens in you? Like, what's your response to it? I mean those critical voices.
You just believe them, don't you? If you've heard something long enough.
So it's a kind of collusion with that. That's how it is.
I'm not actually being quite honest there, sorry. There's a bit of me that goes with it. There's a bit of me that says, no, hang on a minute. Yeah, so there is a part of me that says, that's just your opinion, that's your stuff, that's your transference, that's your issues. There's a
place that you can see it. But I suppose the challenge is with certain individuals that it then goes back to the weaponizing of the threat of suicide, right? That if you actually challenge it and you go back and you say, well, that's just simply not true. How dare you speak to me that way? The fear is then that that's going to escalate the behavior. And so it sort of forces you to stay in that dynamic.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Lots to think about.
I think how you speak to and respond to, you know, certain people is not the most important piece right now. You know, that may change and that may evolve over time. The important piece is what happens inside of you, you know, and that place in you which is colluding in a sense is like, well, yes, that's true, because it's the safer way to respond in that moment. Yeah. I think is doing so with the best of intentions. It's trying to keep the status quo and it's trying to keep things sort of predictable and familiar. The problem is that you don't want the predictable and the familiar. Like if I sort of reflect back, part of what I'm hearing is that there's a really strong place in you that wants things to change and wants things to be different. And historically might have believed you weren't worthy of that and is starting to question that. And it's starting to actually, maybe you are worthy of this. And there's also a place in you that was like, well, what's the point anyway? I've got to stay in a place of service to, you know, certain people. And then once that's done, you know, whatever. And then you're having some connections and friendships and contact in the world that's like, wow, this actually feels good. Like, actually, I want more of this. And then it's like, well, maybe it could be different. Maybe you can change, and maybe if you change, maybe some of the circumstances can change and be different. And that's a whole new potential world, isn't it?
Yeah, I just look at it and just see things I'm afraid of, though. Yeah.
What do you see that you're afraid of?
Yeah, sorry, I just take so long to process stuff.
Please don't apologise. Yeah. We're whistle-stop touring through the entire parts of your life and looking at them from different angles and perspectives. It takes some time to process, you know.
There's so much information and I don't want to come across like I'm stuttering and I don't know and I'm all this and that and the other. The way that my mind works is when I'm presented with the new information, I think about it and just I have to process stuff.
In your first session, there's often a lot of new information. And you're exposed to perspectives that might not have previously been considered, particularly when your beliefs and behavioral patterns are deeply instilled. At this point, I need to be careful not to overload Hayley.
But what happens in these conversations obviously is part of it. And I'm mindful that I've thrown quite a lot of you already today. So I want to give you some time just to digest and metabolize and think about what we've been talking about. And are you someone that journals or writes down?
Yeah, every day.
Yeah, so journaling about this would be helpful. And it would also be helpful for me to share what feels okay to share of that. It doesn't have to be everything that you journal, of course, but particularly some of the key things we've talked about today, just how they land in you, and some of those key things particularly being, I challenge this belief around I'm not worthy of things changing, or I don't believe it's possible for things to change. I made a point around how much strength you actually do have in terms of things that you've done that have been difficult in your life. We talked a bit about the weaponizing of suicide, and I talked about how actually the importance of being freed from that. So there's quite a lot just to go and sit with and kind of find your kind of place with. And some things may land quite neatly. Oh, that just I get it. Other things may not land, and other things sort of partially land. Oh, but how about this? So it just needs some time for that to settle. But there's what happens in these sessions, but what's often more important is the time between where that process is happening, but also giving you access to some resources which will help deepen some of the understanding of what we're talking about. So I'm a big believer in psychoeducation, that if we can make sense of our experience and we can understand the theories and the approaches that give context to that, that in of itself can take away some of the anxiety about the anxiety almost. So I'm going to give you access to an online program that I have, which is called the Reset Program. And it's
for more information on the Reset Program, which Hayley is going through as part of our work together, please visit reset.alexhoward.com for a free 3-part video series.
And the way that I work tends to be to work at some different levels, right? So there's the level of rational awareness of what's happening. There's the level of beliefs that we have about ourselves, about other people, about the world. There's then the habits and the behaviors that we have and working to change those. There's then the deeper emotions and the traumas and the histories that often underpin that. And often we need to work on all of those levels to be able to have sort of lasting change. So we'll bring those different pieces in as is kind of helpful and appropriate. I've been asking you questions for the last hour. What questions do you have for me?
Oh. Oh, yeah. I don't know what to say. Thank you. I think I said before to Oliver, I'm just very humbled that you're willing to help, and that you've said some nice things about me. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. I think it's important to say that my job is not to just say nice things to make you feel better. So if I say something, I mean it. And sometimes my wife might say it to a point of being quite cold and direct to people. But my job is to say what I see. And ultimately, what's important is how you see yourself, really. And that's what we're working on. That I asked you what you hope to get out of this. If I was to express what, having spent the last hour together, what I hope for you to get out of it is for you to see yourself in the beauty as you are, not through all these veils of all of this history and all of these things that you've been told, which are other people's traumas projected onto you and other people's dysfunction projected onto you. The goal here is just for you to see you as you are, without all of those obscurations and all of that history, which is not your stuff.
Yeah, it's trauma projected. Yeah.
Good. You may well, what often happens in these situations is someone gets in the car, starts driving home and goes, oh my God, I know the question I wanted to ask, I think I should have said. So you'll have my email from when I email you later, and you're welcome to use that as you need to. So if questions come up or any concerns come up or anything you want to raise, you're obviously incredibly welcome to do that as well.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Feeling unworthy is a very common experience. Hayley has lived with this feeling for so long that she's normalized to it. But just because we've normalized to something, it doesn't make it healthy or optimum for our lives. And ultimately, changing is hard. and it takes courage and commitment to do so. That is Hayley's challenge, as it is for many of us. So come along on the journey with Hayley over the next 8 weeks as we release weekly episodes of her sessions with me. You can listen here as a podcast or watch the episodes in video on YouTube. And to help support you in coming on the journey with us, I've created some materials to accompany the series. Each week, there is a bonus video with me and a worksheet to bring the sessions to life for you. You can find these resources for free at intherapy.alexhoward.com. Here's what's coming up next week.
I don't care if I never feel safe again as long as I keep them safe.
Your inner sense of safety is dependent upon variables that are not under your control. And then you're finding ways to excuse behaviour that I'm not sure that you should be excusing.
I think it's probably killing me, to be quite honest. I mean, you don't have a heart attack at 39 with no risk factors, really, do you?
In Therapy with Alex Howard is produced by Jeremiah Fernandez, Alex Howard himself, and me, Oliver Hawes. For more information, visit alexhoward.com.